Welcome to the podcast. This episode is brought to you by Maison Beljanski, providing natural supplements for helping your body's healing and wellness, inspired by over 40 years of groundbreaking research. Clement, what's happening, brother? How you doing?
Living life about yourself. I love the background, dude. It looks killer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, living life. I love it. Yeah, living to the fullest every day, right?
Yeah, and then you're in Jacksonville, right?
Yeah. What about you?
I just moved to Venice Beach, so I feel you on the beach life.
Nice. Yeah, Venice is a crazy place. Man, I have had some wild experiences there back in the day, I'll tell you what.
It's pretty fun. We just had the fires last week, so that was a little crazy, just like seeing the mountain just erupt in flames.
Yeah, that's nuts. Did you guys fare okay over there where you're at? Like, did it get down into Venice in the city or no?
No, thankfully it stopped like right before Santa Monica, but like the whole Palisades, which like has some beautiful houses, some good parks, was all destroyed, which kind of sucked, but it's like
Yeah.
a phoenix, right? It rises from the ash.
That's crazy, man. It's crazy what's happening, all the little stories I've heard about it too, like, just a lot of the politics behind it and stuff and how a lot of that could have been prevented and there was a warning ahead of time that it was probably going to happen and then there was the reservoirs were like apparently dried up. I don't know all of it. I didn't really look into it, but you start hearing these things and you don't know exactly what's true and what's not, but maybe you do. You're right there in the mix of it.
Nah, similar boat to you. My X speed is just that same thing of what you're talking about.
So, yeah, thanks for jumping on the podcast. Excited to have you here. Tell me a little bit. Tell my audience just a little bit about yourself. You have a really kind of unique and diverse background. I know you spent a lot of time in mindfulness and so forth, but I also saw that, you're into rocket science research and, all kinds of cutting edge scientific stuff, but also helping to kind of take some of these theories and even Einsteinian understandings of universal principles and kind of bring them into a practical, understandable approach for people. Yeah, talk a little bit about that and kind of the work that you do. I'm really curious.
Yeah, for sure. So I'll give you a nice little synopsis. So, born in Belgium, moved to Spain, and then moved here when I was six. Went to a small school with like 20 people until like eighth grade, and then went to high school with 700 people, and then college with 10,000 people in my grade. So just like kept shooting upwards. Did mechanical engineering in college, then did a 1-year MBA right afterwards. Went to IBM to do consulting. And so it was like on the federal side. Got to work on some cool projects, did a lot of patents, which was really interesting. Worked on large deals, like we did a $10 billion cloud deal for the NSA, which was interesting. But fell into the purpose gap,
Wait,
like.
was that the deal where that helped them be able to store all of the footage and audio and all the recordings of listening to
Probably.
our conversations and spying on our cell phones and listening and watching us through our cameras on our laptops and all that stuff?
Dude, honestly, the like we ended up losing the deal, so I was kind of like okay with it at the end of the day. But like it was still like messed up. That no, I totally agree with you. Like they're always it's funny how like we give smack to like other countries like China for like surveilling, but like we do it ourselves on a massive scale and are okay with it. Okay with it.
What was the film? Did you see that film about, I can't remember the name of it. Maybe it's the Snowden film, actually. I think
Yeah.
that's a really good one if you haven't seen it, which goes into all that. But there's another one too, I'm trying to remember, about the whole exactly how that happened and how it got kind of slipped through. I mean, a lot of us heard about this and right where the government was basically given all the power in the world to spy on us, and majority of Americans had no idea that it's happening, that they're gathering all our conversations, all our videos, all our text messages, all our social media, and literally spying on everything we do every single day, right? And they did it totally, I mean, really, it should be illegal. I mean, but yeah, giving crap to, communist countries and say, oh yeah, they spy on people, you have no freedom. It's like that's exactly what happens here every single day.
Yeah, it's like the big brother thing. I just got finished reading this book, We, which is like the precursor to 1984, and it's like similar vibes. It's the whole dystopian genre, which is one of my favorite ones to read about. Just it's interesting.
It's just we, just W-E.
Yeah, we. It's a good read. It's yeah, if you like 1984, you'll love this one.
Let's check it out.
Yeah, but yeah, so fell into the purpose gap, didn't really know what I wanted to do. I listened to a guy named Naval Ravikant who founded AngelList, and he's kind of like the man. And so he said, you got to do something that'll make you money while you sleep so you can free up your time. So I decided to write a book on things that withstood the test of time, which was math, physics, and history. And then kind of just grew from there, right? This concept of an idea space came out. The book is done. The cards came out to complement the book. Got a YouTube channel now that's starting to come out, and then an AI meditation app that's coming out as well. So been a fun ride.
That's awesome. So, yeah, idea space. So, like, what is the concept behind that? What does that mean?
Yeah, for sure. Good question. So I think before getting into the concept, it's good to talk about like why it's important. And the whole idea of it is like just try to explain the mind in a scientific way, the same way we describe like stars or like molecules. And the reason that's important is because like when Isaac Newton came up with gravity, right? People were probably just like, oh, this doesn't matter, right? It's just like it's like a theory and idea. But then like over time, people find ways to use that theory to for their own benefits, right? Whether it's to launch rockets into space, make cars turn, or whatever. And so in a similar theoretical lens, at least, right? The whole point of an idea space is to give the mind as a sort of this mathematical foundation that sets it up to exist within the realm of physics. And so your idea space consists of your thoughts, emotions, sensations, perceptions, and the empty set. The empty set is intuitively nothing. So your idea space also has two key properties. The first is that it has zero measure, which means it looks like nothing to everybody else. And the second is that it's uncountable or impermanent, which just means that your idea space is always changing from moment to moment, right? It's never static. And so that was kind of like the framework. And then the key is like, all right, well, how does this fit into the rest of what we've got, right? And so that was kind of the genesis for the book and the idea space in general.
Yeah, it's very interesting, especially when we talk about, the emptiness of the mind, for example, which is one of the goals of Buddhism, one of the goals of meditation, one of the goals of Zen is to, get to a state of emptiness in the mind, to a state of actually meditating on emptiness, right? It's a powerful practice. There's a powerful yogic practice in meditation as well as meditating on being hollow and empty. And as we kind of tap more and more into that emptiness, what we find is actually there's this vast, infinite, unlimited world of potential that arises out of that emptiness, right? We think, oh, emptiness, there's nothing, it's empty, there's no value there, right? In today's modern, fast-paced, crazy world where it's all about, right, inventions, you talk about, getting patents and companies and tangible items and products and services, like the idea of emptiness for most people is like that sounds stupid and boring and insane and pointless. And yet, all the greatest inventors of all time have all had a beautiful and profound relationship with that space of emptiness, with that aspect of what you're calling the idea space, right? Where there's a part there that is where we tap into as, Gurudev Sri Sri Ravi Shankar says, he says, silence is the mother of all creativity. And silence, the practice of silence, actually, I just did a silent meditation retreat up in North Carolina recently, and that's going into silence for a number of days and meditating 5 or 6 hours a day. It takes you into that deeper space of calmness and stillness to where creative ideas can be birthed. Whereas when our mind's constantly 24/7 chaotic all the time, it's like you don't have as much access to that creativity. But I think every successful creative person has tapped into that, right? Whether it's in the shower, you finally kind of calm down and it's like you're just like laying in the water and then boom, you get this idea of something you've been thinking towards or solution to a problem. But we can access that intentionally, which is what all the great masters of spiritual traditions around the world have been teaching for thousands of years. Is that kind of also, do you have Does that connect with what you're teaching around the idea space?
Yeah, dude, you hit the nail on the head very, very well. So there's like that quote that you said reminded me of another one where it's like, I'm gonna butcher it a little bit, but it's like silence isn't empty, it's full of answers. And another thing that you hit on that's like super important is like the idea that the emptiness looks like nothing, right? But the conundrum is that you have something that can have zero measure that also looks like nothing. Like, for example, if I take a ruler and I measure something that has zero measure, I get zero. If I get a ruler and I measure something that's empty, I also get zero. And so you get zero and empty look the same, but they're not the same thing, right? And so that's kind of why in your idea space, we're saying it has zero measure, so it looks like nothing. But clearly, you and I know there's not nothing there, right? Like you have your own idea space, your own mind, I have mine. And it's, we need a new science to study it, right? In the science of objects, physics, geology, biology, we can use rulers, sensors, you name it, to like study it scientifically. But when, how do you study something that has zero measure, right? That isn't, doesn't conform to traditional measurements. And I think that's where the beauty of like meditation practices, Zen, Stoicism, different sorts of philosophical inquiries come in, right? It allows you to just study the mind in the same way that you would in the science of objects. And there's a good quote by Munindra Jee, which said, if you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it. And so I think that's kind of the beauty of these practices. They allow you to study your idea space objectively.
I mean, I agree. I follow with what you're saying, but I have a question on what you said. You said if you take a ruler and measure something that has no measure, then you can't measure it. Like how, what would be something that you would measure with a ruler or something similar, right? That would not have a measure.
Yeah, so I think your the principal example of this is your idea space or your mind. So just to like, make this more tangible, like hold something in your hand. Like I'm holding this pen, right? You could be perfect. So clearly you can see it. I can see it. You can feel it. But now close your eyes and bring to mind a mental image of that pen. Do you see a mental image of that pen in your mind? Can I see the mental image of that pen in your
Can you see? I mean, it depends
mind?
how advanced you are in your
Yeah.
meditation practices.
Yeah, but you can open your eyes now. But like, I think the key is like, I can't physically see right now in the same way that I can see this pen, what's happening in your mind, right? The exact representation of that image of the pen.
Yeah,
And
but see,
so,
if you read, autobiography of a yogi and, Yogananda's teachers, he talks about how Sri Yukteswar and Lahiri Mahasaya and these great saints and teachers out of India, for example, they would be able to see that. They can connect to the mind, the thoughts that are in someone's mind and directly know exactly what they're thinking and even direct their thinking in a way that's beneficial for them, right? So I know it's not, I know you're trying to make an example that's just us right now, you can't see it. And so, yeah, you wouldn't be able to measure it. But, to kind of counteract that, I think we have that potential as human beings when we tap into our higher consciousness. That's just what I believe.
yeah, and I think there's like probably different degrees of it, right? Where like, let's call it like emotional intelligence for a catch-all, right? Of like being able to just see how someone is feeling, how someone is thinking, and being able to interpret that in some way, shape, or form. But I think like to see perfectly, like to step into their shoes and like be them, to know what they're sensing specifically, what their awareness is on, whether it's like their left foot, their right foot, their arm, their shoulder, right? That's a little less trivial, right? And so that's kind of where that concept of zero measure comes into play. But like you said, it's like an example, and there definitely are the there's a spectrum to the madness.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, silence would be one of those things you couldn't really measure, right? Because it's like
Yes.
the tools we have to measure sound, you can measure sound, but when that tool is no longer measuring, when there's absolute silence, there is no sound, you're not really, you have an absence of sound, right? Like with light, right? Light. Darkness is the absence of light. As soon as light's on, then there's no more darkness, right? So it's like you can measure light, but can you measure darkness? You can measure sound, but can you measure silence? It's like, can we measure things that are in the absence? But bring that into like, I think the answer is no, right? Can you measure those things? Or they're just the absence of it, and is
Yeah,
that a
and that's like,
measurement?
and like that's a good another good quote by an astronomer who said, "Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence," right? Just because it looks like this absent, right? It that the concept of like zero and absence looking the same. It's yeah. So it's like that's why silence is beautiful, because it's like even though it looks like there's nothing there, you get all these answers, you get all this wisdom. And yeah, like I did a silent retreat, I would say like 2, 3 years ago now, and I feel like I'm due for another one.
Yeah.
But it's so like good on the soul, man, just to like feel human again, basic things of sleep, walk, meditate, eat, and that's it. No other troubles of life come in your way. How
Yep.
was your experience in North Carolina?
You turn off the phone, and part of it too is like don't be writing, don't be texting, don't be making long. Like my wife was like, I looked over it because we had our children too, 14 and 9 year old, so it was like even more difficult. And so I'm trying to communicate with them the least amount absolutely possible with gestures and things like that. And I look over and she's got like a whole page written of a conversation on her phone that she's like showing. And I'm like, that's not silence. Like the whole point is to really slow down and limit our thinking and our outward energy as much as possible and go inside and pay attention what's going on inside, right? And get more in tune with ourselves, because in this world we live in today, most people are not in tune with themselves. It's always this outward projection, constantly focused on everybody and everything outside of me coming at me and me coming at them and defending and repulsing and attracting and bringing in, right? It's like this constant. And it's like when you can just like drop all that for a period of time and just go inside, like you said, like be super simple, meditation, you're eating, sleeping, maybe some deep thinking, but a lot of it is just like working on letting go and calming down and relaxing. I loved it. Like I could do more time of it. I would love to do it even more. Be in a space where I could even dive deeper into the silence. Obviously, I have my children there, so it was even more challenging. And my son, he had a meltdown one day, so like I had to break the silence to like help with that situation. But that was a mirror for myself, and it's like I got angry, and like here I am working on being peaceful. And so it was a really good, mirror and challenge and opportunity to grow and to become even more self-centered and peaceful and connected inwardly. I recommend getting into a silence practice or silence retreat, silence meditation, at least for a few days to everybody. Like some people, it totally changed their life that were in our group. Like it was crazy. I'll tell you, this was really fascinating. So in the first day and a half, we're talking, we're kind of doing some like workshop type stuff and getting to know each other and sharing life stories and things like that. And then once we go into silence, obviously there's no more talking, and we're guided through meditations like 5 or 6 hours a day, maybe chanting in the evenings. This was a yoga retreat, yoga from the whole holistic approach of yoga, not just physical yoga as people think of yoga today, but more of the meditative spiritual aspects of yoga. And by the last day, I didn't recognize anybody in my group. It was crazy. Like, I don't know what happened, but I think everybody was so transformed. When I looked around, I was like, did they change my group? Like, what is going on here? Like, I don't know. It was so interesting to me. Like, people afterwards would come up and talk and like talking to me about the group and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, you were in my group? But we went around and connected eye to eye, face to face, said hi to everybody in the group on the first day. And usually in a group experience like that, like I don't remember everyone's names, but I recognize faces and kind of energy, But by the end of this, I think everyone was so transformed. Like I didn't recognize almost anybody. It was crazy.
How did your like kids deal with it? Because I know 9 and 14, that's like an interesting age to have that experience where I feel like kids are more receptive to some of the teachings of yogi and Buddhism and Zen, right? Versus people who are just like older and have to unlearn everything before they can
Right.
learn the new stuff, right? So how did they kind of, I know you said one had a breakdown, but like how did they kind of handle the whole situation?
Yeah, so they had programs for the kids. This was at the Art of Living Retreat Center. So they had programs for the kids. So the kids weren't in silence. But they told me a couple times, they're like, we don't like it. You guys are in silence. You can't talk to us, because it was just a lot more peaceful over meals, because we always get together for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I'll tell you, the interaction was just quiet and peaceful between us, which was actually really nice. If you're married and you have kids, and you want, a break, go to a silent retreat. It's wonderful for you. You'll love it, trust me. But my kids were kind of like, I don't like this that you're silent, but they were also okay with it. They weren't in silence, right? But because we were in silence, they were much more naturally in silence, so they weren't talking as much because obviously we would be talking with them with us, them each other. But like they probably talked 50, 60% less just because we were in silence ourselves.
Plus, I'm sure they had like different workshops for them to do.
Yeah, they
So,
were
like, they
playing
got
games the whole
exposed.
time. They did learn some pranayamas, some breath work, some meditations, like short versions that are easier for kids, but then and then kind of some personal development stuff and spiritual stuff, but like a lot of it was, just keeping the kids engaged. They're doing games, and like my daughter's group, they actually made cards, handmade cards, and then practiced this was over Christmas, so it was like a Christmas song. I can't remember, it was Jingle Bells or something. And then they went to the retirement home or the old folks home, and they went and gave cards to everybody and sang them, Christmas songs. And like that was like really touching for my daughter because, they were in tears, and the elderly people were so grateful. It was actually a really beautiful experience for the kids. So, my son fights up against anything like that or anything new, and so that was a challenge. My daughter loved it. She had like five or six friends by day two or three, and they're all running around doing their friend girl thing, having fun. So she had a great time. Yeah.
That checks out though. But that's cool that they got into it. Yeah, I feel like when I was that age, I would never have done something like that just because, like, I didn't know that it existed, right?
Oh,
I feel like
bro, that would
it's.
have changed my life. If I was, that would have set me on a totally different trajectory. If I was at something like that, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, I probably would not got into smoking cigarettes, drinking alcohol, smoking weed, doing hard drugs, all the things I did at a very young age. Like, if you can get your kids to do these kinds of programs, it'll absolutely, I think, keep them on a much better trajectory. Then, we get busy as parents and kind of like hand over a lot of the parenting and education to the schools and, aftercare programs and sports. And, sometimes those coaches are not the greatest people to have your kids around. Sometimes those teachers are not the greatest people. And then you get a few hours a day with them, and it's usually, parents are stressed out. They're overburdened, overworked, not in a job they love. So it's like, just that energy and environment that you're putting your kids into. So taking that time for yourself and then creating some kind of spiritual practice, meditation practice, whatever it is that keeps the family lifted up. Like, I think that's so much more valuable and important than all the little things that we think are important for our kids and our family,
Yeah, and I think like one of the conundrums with that is just like, so like you have just like use the same language. If you have your personal idea space, I have my personal idea spaces. But like when we talk and interact, we create like a macro idea space, right? A combined one. And that happens for collective consciousness in a way, right? And that macro idea space is responsible for language, money, social norms, laws, governments, scientific theories, even, right? And just like an idea space, they're impermanent. They're always changing. Like Latin didn't exist, then it existed, and now it's a dead language. And so I think a lot of humans have a tendency to put their energy into those sort of imagined realities, which is really hard because they're changing all the time. And so it's really painful when they change and you attach to them, right? But that's why it's kind of key to what you're saying, right? The key to it is like, all right, what if I can put my energy into some more objective realities, like your health, your relationships with other people. I think once you kind of like see what's real and what's not, even though if you know it's real, like you kind of know it's true, just being able to just like see it clearly, it's a world of difference, man. Just being able to really focus on what truly matters, I think that just makes life easier, makes it have more, it's easier to have a happier life. And like Charles Darwin said, it's like at the end of the day, it's the happy that survive and multiply. So yeah, no, I echo what you say 100%.
So let me ask you about the idea space a little bit more. So, well, a couple questions. One, is this a term that you coined, trademark, came up with, or does this come from physics or science or somewhere else? I guess that's question one. And then two is like, help me understand more of the concepts of the idea space. I mean, you started to touch on it, and then we went on some different directions, but like, yeah, can you break it down even further, and then how it can be useful for people as well to like understand this?
Of course, yeah. So I came up with it, or like the thought entered my mind at some point and was like, idea space, like, what is that? What if we took math and put it to the mind? What would that look like? And so it's like, as much as I came up with it, it's like kind of like the idea came to me in a way. Yeah. And so just kind of dive deeper into it. I'll talk to a little bit about something called the sunset conjecture, which is best explained through a little short story. Imagine you're at the beach. You're chilling, having a pina colada, maybe just relaxing. The kids are away on their silent retreat, and the sun's golden rays are reflecting right off the water towards you. And you're like, wow, this is beautiful. But then your friend or wife is next to you and says, no, silly, the sun's golden rays are reflecting right off the water towards me. And so you're both right, right? Everybody has a unique perspective of the universe, but like, why does that happen? And that's kind of the goal of the sunset connector, to explain this phenomenon, which is twofold. The first, everybody lives at the center of their own observable universe, which is a giant sphere centered on you, where everything you see is in the past. And second, at the center of this observable universe lives your idea space of uncountable depth and zero measure, hidden from the world. And so, to break that down a little bit more, the reason everything we see is in the past is because it takes time for light to go from point A to point B, right? So the sun, it takes 8 minutes for that light to reach us. So we're seeing how the sun was 8 minutes ago. And you can kind of extrapolate that thought process for so on and so forth. And you get this idea of like the farther back in space you see, the farther back in time you're actually seeing, right? So the James Webb telescope that was launched a couple of years ago now is observing some of the earliest stars by just looking really far back in space. And so you get this weird question of like, all right, if everything we see is in the past, then what is the farthest that we can see? And the answer to that is the beginning of time itself, right? Because if you're always looking farther and farther back in the past, then the beginning, then the farthest you can see is the hypothetical Big Bang, right? The beginning of time. And just like a sunset, that edge of your observable universe is setting on you uniquely. And so it's kind of hard to like understand why this matters. And that's kind of why I go back to a little bit earlier what I was saying. It's like you get this concept and you can just see the world more clearly. But just like a sunset saw you uniquely, the edge of the observable universe, or the Big Bang, is setting on you uniquely. And it's still unfolding in your observable universe today, just on the very edge. And so I think the beauty of that, in my mind, is that you always have the possibility to reinvent yourself, right? No matter what you're doing, what is happening, the universe is still being created. And because of that, you also have the opportunity to reinvent yourself. So all the stories you tell yourself of who you are, what you are, and why you can do certain things and why you can't do certain things are fugazi. And so, yeah, that's kind of a deep dive onto that part.
You know, with the cold and flu season here, it's critically important that we enhance and strengthen our immune systems. Yes, would you agree? The problem is, though, that there's so much confusion out there when it comes to what actually works for our bodies and for our health. Well, I'll tell you what I used. I used Maison Beljanski's wellness products. Maison Beljanski's products are backed by science to not only help empower the immune system, but can support detoxification and contribute to our overall health. Coming from Europe, the all-natural Beljanski formulas are now available in the United States and are recommended by top doctors everywhere. A lot of the colleagues I work with, functional medicine practitioners that work with patients with all kinds of diseases, are recommending Maison Beljanski's products to their very own patients. As a special sponsor of this podcast, Maison Beljanski has included a very special discount offer for all of my listeners. You can get 15% off your first order using the promo code Nathan, and you'll always enjoy free shipping when you order four products or more. You can grab your wellness products today at maisonbeljansky.com. That's Maisonbeljansky, maisonbeljansky.com, and use code Nathan for 15% off. Hey, welcome back to the podcast. Before we get started, I want to give you a free gift that I have spent over a decade researching thousands of hours of peer-reviewed studies and interviewing hundreds of world-leading functional medical doctors and cancer conquerors that lays out a blueprint for helping your mind and body become a cancer-fighting fortress for natural cancer prevention and healing. And that's my Amazon number one best-selling book, Becoming Cancer-Free. The physical copy sells for like 10 bucks on Amazon, which, you know, you can go get that if you want, but I'm happy to give you the ebook absolutely free. Just head over to becomingcancerfree.com and you can download that ebook instantly. Again, that's becomingcancerfree.com, and it's yours as a gift from me to you for tuning into this podcast. All right, let's get to the show. Yeah, I think also understanding sunset conjecture, kind of that concept, will absolutely reduce the amount of suffering in our lives and our relationships, right? Because very often, right, conjecture is like, coming to a conclusion with incomplete information, right? It's like we see things our way, but we don't see it their way. So we get in these arguments and these fights and these battles. I'm right. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. And it's like, well, you're both right. And maybe you're both wrong. But at the end of the day, it's like if we can see basically the underlying, I would say the underlying spiritual practice there that supports kind of your sunset conjecture idea is compassion, right? It's having compassion and understanding and empathy for everybody around us when we realize that, oh, this person is seeing things through their lens and their eyes and their perception. And I'm seeing things through my lens and my eyes and my perception. And this we're butting heads because we both want to be right, and our egos are like, no, I'm right, no, I'm right. And then we fight and bicker, and then nobody's happy at the end of the day, you know? It's like this very funny, weird thing we do as human beings where it's like we force ourselves into, we want to be right, and I think a lot of times people want to be right. It's also about like you want to help the other person because if they see the way you see, then you think that they're going to be better because of it. Whether that's true or not, you know, but it never helps them to be better, right? Because it's like, I force my ideas onto you and all they do is like back away or fight against you or, you know, so I think there's a healthy way to do that and there's a very unproductive and unhealthy way to do that.
Yeah, and the idea that like something, there's another concept in the book is this concept of clopen, which is just putting the words closed and open together. And that's a mathematical concept that exists. And the whole idea there is that two seemingly opposite things can coexist at the same time.
Yeah.
Like for instance, there's objects in this world that are both open and closed. Like just to get a feel for it. Do you remember like the dress, the picture of the dress that came out a couple of years ago? Where
the
it was
dress?
Like this. Yeah. Where it was like, is it black and blue or is it white and gold?
I don't think I saw that.
Give it a nice Google after this and then ask your kids and wife
is it
what
just
color
called
they
the
see.
Dress?
Yeah.
Okay, let's pull it up. Let's take, for those who are watching, let's take a look at this because I don't think I've seen this.
Yeah, so like, yeah, what color do you see on like the, I would say that this picture to the left of it, the Scientific American one,
Scientific American,
that one. Yep. To the right, up one.
Oh, there it is.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, what color do the dress do you see?
This is more like just looking at the dress, what color do I see? Do I see gold and white or blue and or I mean gold and black or blue and white? I see gold and white with a light shade of blue.
I see blue and black.
You see blue and black?
Yes, yeah.
Dude, that is crazy. Are you serious? Like you're looking at the same dress, right? This one right
yes.
here.
Yes.
So
like
so what? Yeah. What part do you see blue? Like the thicker part at the top. The
yeah. So right where your mouse is, right there, that's like a the right there, that's black. But if you go up a little bit, that's blue, light blue.
Dude, that is crazy. So this is like white. This is, I see a shade of blue in here, but it would look also almost like white with a shadow over it. But it's, I'd say whitish blue, and then this is totally gold, like. Like gold, gold with like a shadow over it as well, like some black. All right, so hang on a second. So if I close my eyes and then like, what if I force my mind to see, what do you see, black and blue? All right, black and
yeah,
blue.
Yeah, I tried. It's not, you know, you ever see like the picture of like the young and old lady where it's like, if you look one way, it's
yeah,
a young lady. I wish it was like this, but I've tried so hard. But I think like the key to this is like you could be looking at the same thing in life, right? Not just the dress, and just have two and just see two completely different things, and they're both right. Right? That's like
Wait, so how is it? So what's the explanation of this though? This is crazy because I cannot see black and blue. I see gold and whitish blue. And that this is funny too, right? Because my wife's always like, "That's not blue. That's whatever." And I'm like, "No, that's blue." And I'm like, so now this is starting to make sense.
Yeah, you'll have to show her this if she'll get a good kick out of it. But honestly, I don't really know. I think it has something to, like, I remember Googling it once and it was like something to do with like the pigments in the eye and the way that the eye interprets light.
Let's see what the AI Google tool says. The dress appears different colors, different people because of an optical illusion caused by the way our brains interpret light in an image, lighting in an image, with some people assuming the dress is in shadow. Okay. That's what my brain sees is like it's in a shadow. That's why I see the shadows adjusting to the colors which appear white and gold, while others perceive it as being in normal lighting, seeing it as blue and black. Essentially, it's as a result of our how our brains try to compensate for uncertain lighting conditions in the photo. Okay, so if I'm like, no shadow, there's no shadows, this is perfect lighting. Let's see if I can see it. Black and blue, this is perfect. Wow, no, I can't. I still see gold and whitish blue. That is a trip, dude. So yeah,
Right?
if this doesn't do anything other than say, look, we all may see and perceive things slightly differently. We need to be more understanding and open and compassionate towards each other if we want a more sane and peaceful world to live
Yeah, and that's kind of hard to do sometimes, right?
in.
So it just because it's like everybody, you live in your own world, right? Everybody lives in a little world by themselves. Like, and so I think that's why the beauty of like all these spiritual practices is so helpful, just because, like, same thing you were saying before, like coming back to that allows you to take a step back from those thoughts that you have of like, oh no, I'm right, this person's wrong, or whatever it is. And it just allows for a more kind of like meta perspective on the whole situation. And in my experience, that leads to just a happier lifestyle for just seeing the world more truthfully.
I'm still trying to see if I can adjust my thinking or my brain or my eyes to like change the color of the dress, but it's not working. Like, there's got to be a way to see what he's seeing. Like, let me go into his shoes and see what he's seeing, but man, it's not working. Yeah, that's
Yeah,
crazy. So,
yeah, that's the joy of
clopen,
the dress.
meaning being closed and open at the same time, you were talking about that.
Yes, so that's kind of like the dress is a clopen phenomena, right? Like it's the same, it's one thing, but one person sees it open, one person sees it closed, one person sees it white, gold, true, false, black, white, you name it, right? And in our universe, this happens a lot, right? So, for example, you get the question of are we controlled by the mind or are we controlled by the body? The answer is both,
Right.
right? Are we, do we have free will? In one perspective, we're just made of cells that are made of quarks that are make up our bodies that live in the laws of physics, so we don't. But the other time, I can be mindful of a particular moment, have a choice point, and so we both have free will and we don't at the same time.
I think
And then,
Guru Dev says it
yeah.
best, like, is it destiny or is it free will? And he says, well, your height is your destiny, right? Like, can't change too much about how tall you're gonna be, maybe a little bit, but not much. It's pretty much your destiny. But your width is your free will, right? Like, we have control over that.
Yeah, and we have both. And that's kind of like the beauty of a lot of different things in life where it's both open and closed at the same time. And I think people, especially just in life in general, see it as like one way or the other. And like, I'm sure everyone understands like the world isn't black and white and there's it's a gray in the middle, but understanding it and like living it every day in a day-to-day life is tricky. And that's why understanding that the concept of clopen exists in a mathematical sense, in my mind at least, this allows this like really opens everything up because it shows you because like in life things are seldom true because it's hard to prove something is true, right? Like science is all about falsifiability. You make a hypothesis, you test the hypothesis, and at the end you fail to reject or you reject. You never say it's true. And math, on the other hand, is this only domain where you can really say something is definitively true, just by the nature of its construction. And so when we take these mathematical principles and apply them to our observations, that's the foundation of physics. And so when we take Clopin and apply it to the dress, the free will, particle wave duality that exists in physics as well, you create this like new way of looking at the world of physics.
Yeah, interesting. So I've done a lot of deep thinking on these topics and trying to play devil's advocate and, understand things from a bigger perspective over the last almost, 20 years. And one of the things you said, like math is definitive. So this is kind of an interesting concept to think about, right? Where the math we use today, I think, obviously is definitive in a lot of ways. But what about this? Like, if I say what's 1 + 1 =
Who?
2, right? And you say, you ask any, mathematician or any third grader or whatever, 1 + 1 is always going to equal 2. But expanded beyond that, in universal terms, in terms beyond black and white, 1 + 1 can equal more than 2. And people go, well, what do you mean it can equal more than 2? Think about this. If you have a man plus a woman, do you get 2? No, you get 3. You get a child, or 4, or 5, depending if they have twins or triplets, right? Now, 1 + 1 is not always 2. Sometimes it's 3 or 5 or 7. And that, I mean, it's a really simple example, but it's true though, because sometimes we get so stuck on like it is this way because it's always been this way. But yeah, but what if we incorporate, spirit into it? Not just numbers on a page, and all of a sudden things start to change.
Yeah, and I think that's like math is beautiful, but math exists in its own like particular domain. And like there is Karl Popper has a good quote on it where he says kind of mathematics and logic, where proofs are permitted, don't tell us anything about the world, but only have the means to describe it. Right? So it's like math is just
So it doesn't
like
tell us, what
a
he's saying is it doesn't tell us about like how to understand it at a deeper level, but like just to describe, give it a description.
Yes.
Like almost a measurement. Like I've always said, like time doesn't actually really exist. And this is my philosophy.
Same
It only
page.
exists because we measure it, right? And if you go
Yeah,
to
like,
different and if you
yeah.
go to different planets, like time is totally different because you would measure the days di like we measure time based on distance and speed, but that changes depending on wherever you are in the universe. So there's no such thing as one linear time across the whole universe in my perception, like, and it only exists because we choose to measure it.
Yeah, and you're right. Like physics says the same things. Like everyone has their own personal time. Like for instance, the best way to understand it is like have you seen the movie Interstellar?
Yeah.
Remember when they go to that one planet that's really close to the black hole and that they end up spending 1 minute there and the person in the spaceship end up taking like 20 years?
Do you think that would be actually true? Do you think that's
Yeah.
actually possible? Really?
That's yeah, 'cause that's like time dilation. So like the closer you are to a gravitational well, the slower time slows goes relative to an observer that's farther away.
Now,
And
is
like
that
for
like, have
another,
they really proven that, or is that still pretty much theory?
yeah, no, that's like that's very strong. And so like another example, two more examples is like when you have set, like there's no set true time, like a clock that we are all on the same on, there's different types of like satellites in space versus time here. And some of them are off by like a couple milliseconds in like their standard time. And like a good final example is this idea that space and time are one and the same thing. So for example, when I move in a certain direction relative to a stationary observer, I contract in that direction spatially. So if I'm moving from my left to the right, I'm going to contract in the X dimension. And to make up for that contraction, my time slows down relative to yours. So if you're just telling me it takes 10 seconds for me to go from here to there, then my time slows down. For me, it would take a little bit less time, like 9.999999999. Like it's hard to measure, but it's still like a minute.
Because of what you're doing and what I'm seeing, there's a difference in time. Is that
Just
why?
because of the nature of physics. The way that the universe exists is that space and time are connected. They're one and the same, hence the space-time term, right? And so when you move in a direction relative to someone else, they contract spatially in that direction relative to you. And to make up for that contraction spatially, their time slows down relative to you. And it's just a phenomena that we observe. And the key experiment behind it, right? Because it's all about testing it, is the Michelson-Morley experiment, where they had like two mirrors and they shone a light onto it. And like you could see like the reflection of the light. And the idea was that there would be this contraction called the Lorentz contraction. And when they only took into account the Lorentz contraction of space alone, it didn't work. The math didn't check out. And then they added the Lorentz contraction to the mirror's time, and the math ended up working out to what the observation was. And so that's kind of where they got that initial idea. And honestly, the Michelson-Morley experiment is like, I think, one of the most groundbreaking experiments of all time, just because it shows you that time is personal, like on a micro level. Yeah, so that's time. I'm on the same page with you. Time is a fickle beast.
Time is a fickle beast. So Michelson-Morley experiment is the one you're talking about.
Yes.
So what exactly did they do? So is this a good
Would say that third, go down one, the hyperphysics.
this one?
Yes, that one. Yeah, so the idea was like you have a rest mirror, and like it's been a while since I looked at it, so I'm gonna butcher this super hard. So bear with me on it. But essentially they shone a light and they moved the mirror, like you can see a certain distance. And they saw that there was a tiny little difference in like the wavelength or something. I forget, and I'm butchering it, so I apologize for all the physicists out there who are just like, this guy's an idiot. But there's a good so Richard Feynman put out like his lectures a while back, and it was one of his lecture topics about this that was fantastically stated. So if you are interested, I would definitely check out the Feynman lectures, Caltech. They
Feynman,
were,
like that,
yeah, that one, Feynman.
Feynman. So,
Yep.
what about the
Yeah, that
experiment? Do you
one.
know about the experiment where, so this is quantum physics I'm talking about here, and where they're showing that it actually requires our observation and perception of something for that thing to actually exist? They were starting to prove this by shooting, I think, light through like a beam through a tunnel, something, and then it only showed or changed when they added the observer to observe it. I don't remember exactly the experiment, all the details, and I don't know enough about, physics to fully understand. I'd have to really deep dive into it, and I haven't done that yet. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about the experiment, but I know exactly what you're talking about. And there's like, I read a lot of physics, so this is like right up my alley. But like, it's like the realist viewpoint versus the orthodox viewpoint. I forget which one's which, but one of them is like, does the thing still happen even if
Right.
we don't measure it, or does it need the measurement to happen? And I don't know if they fully, like, it's how do you, like, yeah, like if there is an experiment, I would love to hear more about it, because I know that's been like a debacle in quantum mechanics for a
They call it
minute.
the observer effect. Like, it's the old saying or the old question, like, does it, if a tree falls in the woods and nobody's there to hear it, does it make a sound? Right,
Yeah.
like that's kind of where that saying comes from, and I'm always like, yeah, duh, of course it makes a sound. It fell, it made a sound. But that's kind of what quantum physicists are saying is like, well, in physics in general, like the observer effect is like things actually get disturbed or changed based on a human being, or I don't know if animals as well, but of it actually being observed. And they're showing, I don't, let's see if we can find that experiment because.
A good one is like the double slit experiment, which may be the one that you're thinking of.
Double what?
Double slit. And yeah. And then maybe if you go in the images. Yeah,
Yeah,
there you
two
go. That's.
photon double slit. This, I think this is the one. Let's
Yes.
see.
So this one's interesting. It's like Yeah, this one, this is like the key building block of like all general of all quantum mechanics. It's like, does light act like a wave or does light act like a particle? And the answer is it depends, right? When you shoot an electron or a light through double slits without an observer, like a quote unquote observer, to know which specific slit the electron went through, then you get this sort of interference pattern on the screen, like you see right there, where it would just be like if you pass water through those slits, right? Like the intensity is higher in the middle, then there's like troughs and like a higher intensity. So that Anton PAR 1-2 to the left of that image is does a good job, yes, kind of seeing like the intensity of just like having max and mins, right? So that's the experiment as is. And then you can also do this experiment by setting up a light source behind the second pair of slits to see which hole the specific electron or light went through, right? And when you do that, you get this weird phenomena where can you type in double slit experiment meme? Yes, the top left
Oh
one.
yeah, I've seen this one.
So if you've seen this, so like when you're not looking, the top part, it has this interference pattern. But when you are looking and you put that light source behind there, you can see which holes the electrons go through. And so they did test this experiment and they did confirm it that this happened. And one of the reasons for this is because of something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which essentially states that this is like in the words of Kip Thorne, where like whenever you try to make a measurement, there's like a kick. It's like making the act of measuring something changes the like physics that would happen if you didn't make the observation, right? And that's like clear from this. You're
So
not looking.
this is not, this is the same type of experiment I was thinking of. It's not the exact one. There's another one that's similar. Let's see if I can pull it up. It was not, it wasn't the double slit. It was actually like they were shooting something, I don't know if it was light, electricity or something, through a tube, and let's see, shooting light through some kind of tube or cylinder. And let me get rid of double slit. And then the observer, it's called the observer effect, right? Let's see if I can pull it up. Because it was, it's very similar to this, but different. And it actually, oh man, I can't remember exactly what happened. But it like the thing was there when you observe, but wasn't there when you didn't observe. Like this is changing the outcome based on your observation, right? Which is
Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of what happens in the double slit experiment too, right? Like
yeah, that's what
you're
I mean. Double
changing the
slit's like
outcome.
changing the outcome, right? Very clearly,
Yeah.
which is power, which just goes to show you. And like, I think from a, let's just, I always like to bring things back to like the spiritual or the practical or the day to
Of
day. It's
course.
just recognizing that every thought that we have, every emotion that we have, every intention that we have, literally directly changes our experience on this planet and impacts and affects not only the people and situations and circumstances around us, but the entire planet and the entire universe. This was, you know, shown through the butterfly effect, for example, right? How just the different wing flaps of a butterfly can literally affect entire weather patterns across the world. Well, if a butterfly wing can do that, don't, and we know that just by observing, you know, light going through two slits changes completely, it's like, imagine the amount of power that you actually have as a human being to determine the direction of your life and overcome the challenges that you're facing and break through financial hardships and transform addictions and habits and patterns and relationships by the power of your thinking, the focus of your intention, the amount of observation that you put into whatever it is that you're focused on. And any of us who practice this every day and have gone through this know this to be absolutely true. Right? Like I've transformed my life. I've overcome so many addictions. I've used to be homeless, and you know, now it's like I'm living such a great life now that before I was living one of the worst lives I think somebody could live. And meaning a lot of suffering, a lot of, you know, lost depression, a lot of pain, a lot of physical sickness, to being the healthiest, happiest, most fulfilled I've ever been up to this point. You know, and why? It's like because of these things that we're talking about. It's actually apply them in my life. And that's what I've been sharing with others for so many years, is that you too can live a better life by directing your thinking and your attention and intention on the things that you truly want in your life and being consistent with that. And as the words that you use, the idea space, right? It's like having a, I would say, a deep and beautiful relationship with your idea space, with your mind, understanding your mind and starting to direct your mind in the direction you want it to go and starting to get a sense of control over it instead of your mind, your thoughts, your beliefs, your subconscious beliefs, your patterns, your traumas directly dictating your life and who you are. Starting to get control over that and release those patterns and heal those beliefs and transform yourself. It's totally doable and possible for everybody, anybody at any age. Doesn't mean it's easy, but it's totally doable and possible if you want that.
Yeah, no, you said so many good things. There's so much to unpack there. The first thing that came to mind was a quote by Sam Harris, where he said, "The problem isn't thoughts themselves, but the act of thinking without knowing that we are thinking," right? And that goes back to the observational thing you were talking about. And with the idea space, I think one of the biggest goals for it is just to be able to view your thoughts objectively. I think a lot of us associate our thoughts and emotions with I, who we are. But at the end of the day, like, no one really knows where thoughts come from, they just kind of appear. And they're not all necessarily true. Some are true, some aren't. But when you associate yourselves with them, that's when you can get in and get down this rabbit hole. Because one of the Zen teachings is whatever the mind frequently ponders becomes the inclination of the mind. And so if you're not mindful or aware of all the thoughts that you're having, then you're going to have this spiral. And who knows where that will get you, right? But if there's a certain point that you want to achieve or a certain thing you want to do, and you're able to have your mind shift in a way where those are the thoughts that frequently occur, you're gonna have a whole different life. And all it takes is just a moment of awareness, a moment of awakening, an aha, like, oh, this makes sense. This feels true. This resonates here and now. And everybody experiences these in life. They're called koans in the book, and they're sort of like an
Co, what'd you call
identity.
it? A co and?
Yeah, koan, or yeah,
How do you
it's
spell that?
KOAN.
Koan. So what does that stand for? Oh, like a
It's
cone,
Jap.
like a
Yep.
Buddhist cone, for example.
Exactly. The part of the book is like, all right, how do we take these scientific principles and map them to these more spiritual practices in a way that's like tangible? And so, yeah, the koan, and so Japanese for public case, and it's a tool for spiritual enlightenment. And they're usually ineffable, nonverbal, and it's just a moment of pure awakening. So, for example, koan is, what is the sound of one hand clapping? It's weird. You're not, it doesn't make sense, but sometimes you can feel a really weird tingly sensation in your hand once you hear that. And so, in terms of idea spaces, these koans serve as identities that capture the pure essence of a thought. So, for example, one of the key principles of life is the concept of impermanence, right? Things are always changing. Whatever has a nature to arise has a nature to pass away. And a koan that captures the concept of impermanence very well is this quote by Heraclitus, which is, "No man steps into the same river twice, for it is not the same river, and he is not the same man." And so these sort of identities built the large scale structure of your idea space in the same way that galaxies are birthed from ginormous black holes, right? They have kind of the same sort of effect within your mind. And that's kind of like the, yeah, that's kind of the framing of it within the book.
Yeah, that's that's awesome. I take these scientific mathematical principles and understandings and then tie them to practical and spiritual practices. The koans are, very interesting because they're often like riddles or paradoxes or just a simple statement or, a few sentences that help you to understand things, to awaken, right, to a greater reality, which leads to the conversation around truth that I want to have. But I wanted to read this koan that I think is a really good one, where it says two monks were arguing about the temple flag waving in the wind. One said, "The flag moves." The other one said, "No, the wind moves." They argued back and forth but could not agree. Is it the flag? Is the wind? Is the flag? Is the wind? And Hunang, the sixth patriarch, said, "Gentlemen, it is not the flag that moves. It is not the wind that moves. It's your mind that moves." The two monks were struck in awe. Right? And so, like, there's oftentimes with something like that, it makes you have to go deeper into what I would call universal truths. You know, because we say, yeah, truth is often what we perceive it to be, and they're not always complete truths. And like with science, truths are always being expanded upon. But I also believe that there are like absolute truths. There are universal truths that are true no matter what, no matter who you are, where you are, what you do, no matter what you believe, what spiritual tradition you're part of, what color of your skin, it doesn't matter, right? What religion you're part of, what science, you know, what degrees you have or letters you have behind your name, that there are absolute universal scientific, not even scientific, universal truths that are non-deniable. You can deny them, but they exist whether you like it or not, you know? And I don't know how many of those there are, but I've experienced and seen again and again a few of them over my short lifetime so far. And so I do believe they exist, some of these universal truths. And I would say, you know, one of them is the concept of karma, for example, right? Which is basically action reaction or action result. Like that is something that no matter what, I think is always going to happen, is always going to be a universal truth. It's like if you take an action or you have a thought, that is going to have an effect, and that effect is going to somehow come back to you in one way or another. And you know, the Buddhists obviously believe this, the yogis obviously believe this, the Zen obviously believe this, right? That it, and it's not the sense of like, oh, I broke into a car, so someone has to break into my car. It's that the energy behind that which you do comes back to you. And I've seen it in my own life, I've seen it in people's lives who don't believe this, who actually deny it. I see, right? Like it's just something that I believe to be an absolute universal truth. And I think there's a number of those, but yeah, what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I totally resonate with that. And I think those koans help like enlighten and unveil those truths to us, right? There's this book called The Blue Cliff Record, which is essentially 100 koans written from this master. Forget how long ago it was, but he just assembled them all based on the teachings. And
The
honestly,
blue
such a
what?
good
What'd you call
book,
it? The
The Blue Cliff Record.
Blue Cliff Record.
It's not an easy read in the slightest bit, but it's like you just read one of those a night, and there's so much wisdom in that book. It's exactly like the same koan that you spoke to about, where it's like a little moment of enlightenment. And I think to me, enlightenment isn't like this thing where it's like, oh, I am enlightened, I'm not enlightened, right? Enlightenment is like a pure moment in space and time where mountains no longer become mountains and rivers no longer become rivers. And then it passes, and then mountains become river. Mountains are mountains again, and rivers are rivers again. But they're not the same mountains and rivers that were before the moment of enlightenment, right? And so that's why I think it's so important to like write down your koans, write down things that resonate with you, because they build the large scale structure of your mind, and you can always go back to them. Like I've been writing down like life lessons for like the better part of like 10 years now. And whenever I'm in like a rut or don't know how to deal with a situation, I'll come back to a specific quote that really resonates on that issue. And it's like bypasses the storm of thoughts. And it's like, all right, this is the clarity I needed, and I can move on to the next thing.
Let me ask you a practical question. How do you personally organize your thoughts like that and then be able to go back and find them when you need them or want to reference them? Like, what does that look like for you? Is it a yellow pad with sticky notes and things? Is it, do you type it up and organize it by, I've gone like back and forth on this over the years so many times, and I'm just like, yeah. Anyway, I've have a mess of it all over the place with like this many yellow pads stacked up when I used to write like crazy, and it's just so many like thoughts and ideas and koans and perceptions and things like that I've just like locked away somewhere like in a drawer from many years ago. And then I started like organizing these ideas on Dropbox and categories and folders, and then I stopped that, and then I've got journals all over the place. It's just like it's a big mess. So curious how you organize that.
Yeah, it's hard to do. I have journals as well. I think that's good for just like the flow of conversation and things. But for Moment of Enlightenment, I just keep a notes in my phone,
Okay.
and they're just quotes, some short, some a little bit longer, but it's just been my digital yellow pad, and you just kind of like remember where things are in it pretty easily, just because like you scroll around, you're like, oh, I remember it. And as soon as you read it, you're like, this was the moment of enlightenment that I had. And it brings you back to that moment. And it's really like peaceful.
It's one note document you use,
Yep.
and then you
And
have
just.
like okay, so you're basically talking about you have this kind of aha moment thinking on something or whatever, and it's like it's a phrase or a sentence or something that comes to you, and you write it down. Do you put like anything else around that context or anything? You just kind of write down that thought.
Yeah, just the specific words usually that trigger the aha. So like for example, the very, very first one that I ever wrote was a thought that I had that just resonated really with me, is we are all philosophers in our own mind. And then it just kind of evolved from
That's kind
there
of
to
funny.
like,
We're all
yeah.
philosophers in our own mind. In our own mind, yeah. They think I'm a philosopher. No, they don't think you're a philosopher. But I'm a philo I feel like I'm a philosopher.
Yeah, like I was listening to Walter Isaacson's book on Leonardo da Vinci, and he had a good quote where innovation requires a reality distortion field. And that's like a huge concept. Like you see Steve Jobs, Elon Musk talk about the reality distortion field. Like I think that's such a like it's like a real thing, right? When you're able to impose your reality onto the rest of the world, that's your reality distortion field, where you don't really take what is exists at face value, and you really test it out for yourself. And that's where innovation comes into play.
Reality distortion field. So you're saying that means, it's the first time I've heard that. So you're saying that means that a reality that you see in your mind that's not necessarily widely accepted at the moment, you then impose that upon a larger population and it becomes accepted. Is that what you mean by reality distortion field?
Yeah, exactly. Like, for example, Steve Jobs. Think of it like with the iPhone or something like that, right? Like that didn't exist before. And it's a bunch of people probably telling him that this is a stupid idea and no, it can't be done. And it's just him getting angry and start yelling at you in typical Steve way. Be like, no, you idiot, we're making this happen. It is possible. Or the same thing with Elon, right? And like it works, right? And it's just a matter of first principles thinking of does can it work from a first principle standpoint? If yes, then how do you bring that to life? And how do you convince other people about it? And that's the hard part.
Interesting. Yeah, and is it actually good for humanity?
Oh man, I feel like with all tech, it's like good and bad,
Right.
right? Like the iPhone, great, but also has a lot of qualms with it. And it's printing press, same thing. Let's go back to the beginning of time, and every tech is good and bad.
Yeah, I mean, technology today, it makes us more comfortable, makes us more convenient, definitely makes us more connected. But is it making people happier and healthier? You know, some of it might, a little bit, a lot of it is not. It's making people sicker and more depressed, you know? So
Yeah.
it's a lot of it is becoming aware in our idea space, you know, what technology is doing for you. Is it controlling you or are you controlling it? Is it actually good for you or are these, you know, battery powered cars that I used to be a big proponent of, you know, solar energy and wind energy and battery power and stuff like that until it's like you learn so much more about it, what it's doing to the environment and the EMFs that it's putting off. And I mean, I was interviewing an expert the other day. He says, you know, the Tesla battery under the car is emitting sometimes like 10x amount of the EMFs that, you know, your phone does. And we know phones. You know, there's a lot of science that shows that EMFs and radiation from phones can contribute to DNA damage and mitochondrial damage, which could potentially lead to cancer. There's quite a bit of science on that. And so to have 10 times that amount, if that's the correct number, that you sit on all day emitting into your testicles and your ovaries of your woman and your body, you know, and causing all that damage, like, okay, is it better for the environment? Like these cobalt mines where they're, you know, people are getting really sick
Yeah,
with
those are
cancer, you
ruthless.
know, then destroying the planet and these batteries that are incredibly toxic. Like, yeah, they're cool cars. Yeah, I wanted one for a while. Yeah, they're convenient and comfortable. And like, are they better for the planet? Are they worse? Are they better for your health or worse? think these are bigger questions when someone comes along with this reality distortion field. Is that right?
Yep.
Reality
Yeah, you got
distortion
it.
field come along and like swoop up a whole bunch of people. Like we saw that with COVID, right? If we swoop a whole bunch of people into a certain set of beliefs and get a lot of people following it and believing it, and then is that actually better for you or not? And I think that's the biggest challenge we saw with COVID, which I think is one of the biggest challenges we see with sustainability, with diet, with nutrition, with so many things we see today, right? Where people unfortunately are not using their own reasoning. They're not breaking things down and thinking through it and, right, using some logic and spending a little time going inside and paying attention to their intuition, and then they just get swept along with whatever emotional garbage that's spewed out by, the media or politicians or celebrities who are forcing an agenda on you and go, oh yeah, that's the way. That's I gotta follow them because they know, right? I just gotta follow instead of like, no, let me think through this on my own. Let me meditate on this, reflect, pay attention to my intuition, see what is actually true or not here.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to the macro idea space concept, where like people get easily swept into the collective consciousness and think of it as that's being true. But it's like it's always changing. And that's why it's important, like you said, just to go back to like what's true for you and like testing. Like one of the key principles of all science is like testing for yourself. Don't take anything at face value, even if it seems 100% true. But is it true for you here and now? Right? And what if you apply that same principle to the mind? Where does that get you? And yeah, having it's there was a good quote once I saw where it's important to science, not to study science, right? Like you can study it all you want, but science is like a way of life, it's a lifestyle. And it seemed to have worked pretty well for humans so far. You look at like level of progress, like pre-science, post-science, it's like we got rockets in like 500 years.
That's true. I mean, are the rockets going to do anything for humanity? Who knows? It's one of those
Hey, I'll
things
take
like,
it. I go
is
to
it actually
space. That'd
going
be
to make us
sick.
better or not? Like, who knows?
Yeah, that'll be
But we got them. We got rockets
we got
that can land themselves now,
them.
So we
Yeah,
could spend
hindsight always
$100 to
2020.
go, out of outer space for a few minutes, like, or whatever it costs,
Yeah, dude, it's probably a couple mil. Yeah, I hope in our lifetime at some point it goes down to I'm still thinking it'll be expensive, but hopefully like a number where it's like, ooh, look, is this possible? And
Like a first
just that
class flight
experience.
to India, maybe you could pay that to go to outer space for a
Just
bit.
exactly. That would be, I would potentially do
You're
that
like,
just to like feel
I'm in,
zero
I'm all
G's.
in.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't. I know it excites a lot of people. It honestly doesn't excite me that much, just because I'm like, I love planet Earth. I mean, I get so much joy and fulfillment. I mean, I can sit outside in the sunshine and just be in total like peace and joy and start to feel bliss just relaxing here. I'm like, do I need to go? I go to a roller coaster, and it's like get that adrenaline and that kind of thing once in a while. And I'm like, yeah,
Course.
it's okay, that's fun, but whatever. Do I need to do that again? No, not really. Like it doesn't. There's no nothing lasting there. And I think there's an appeal to going off the planet and exploring and all of that. It certainly appeals to people. It's certainly with the explorative mind. And but like, is that going to make anybody happier, healthier, more fulfilled? People have this idea, oh, I have to leave Earth because we're destroying it. I gotta go to another planet. And it's like, no, we can all live here peacefully and healthfully for thousands of years, if we just start to believe that and work together. You don't have to leave this planet, but some people feel like they don't belong here, I guess.
Yeah, for me, it's just like being. I just want to see what the Earth looks like with my own eyes. I
You want to
heard
see if
that.
it's actually flat or round. That's
Oh,
the truth,
no.
right?
No, I think it's just like I hear all these astronomers that go up there and say it's like this ineffable feeling of just pure joy and happiness and like of just seeing the Earth for how beautiful it is from that perspective. And I don't know, that would just be an experience all of our ancestors never got the opportunity to have. So, yeah, it tickles me fancy.
No, I've heard that too, that it is very, very transformational, like spiritually awakening for these guys,
Yeah.
like astronauts and so forth. No, legit, though, I have a really good friend who's very brilliant, very well respected, very well researched, who recently told me he's like a legit flat earther. And I'm just like, okay, that's cool. Like, he's like, prove it to me. Like, and then they're like, well, prove to me that the earth is round. I'm like, well, we've got all these photos and stuff. He's like, yeah, they're all made up. They're all these stories. And he sends me all these videos and stuff. I'm like, because it's actually starting to have a convincing argument. I'm like, all right, I still think it's round, but
I think
it's a
like
crazy
the
that that conversation has actually come up again, and it's created so much heat and debate and like anger amongst people. It's like, does it really matter if you believe the earth is flat or round? Like, does that really matter?
Yeah, I think the in science it's or in physics it's mostly like this concept of everything is locally flat but has global curvature. So like for example, let's say you walk around the earth. The entire time you're walking around the earth, you'll be like, this was a straight walk. I walked in a flat line. But you ended up exactly where you started, which is a geometrical a property of a greater circle, right? Of a sphere. And so that holds for everywhere on the universe, right? In our observable universe, everything looks locally flat. So you can just use the real numbers in a reference frame, but it has global curvature on the outside, when looking from the outside in. So life is, the universe likes to play. I think like the universe is like a comedian and it likes to play tricks and be like, gotcha. Oh, I got you there too. And it's like us trying to figure it out. Like, hey, what are you doing?
That's a good point. That is a good point. I can see that pretty often. It's like, made you think that, but it's not that at all. Like, oh, I got it now. And then you're like, oh, nope, I definitely don't have it.
It's like is a universe a tragedy or a comedic play? And in my mind it's comedic because like tragedy plus time equals comedy. So it's like no matter what you do at the end of the day, like you gotta laugh, you gotta smile. Like Darwin said, it's like the happy, the survive and multiply. And from an evolutionary standpoint, that resonates with me pretty strongly.
Well, so the yogis, the Vedanta philosophy, for example, or the yogis that talk about God or creator, is that the creator, that God created Earth in this material existence that we have, as it is God's play. It's exactly what it is. It is a play, and that, that's why the Buddhists call it Maya, right? The great illusion or delusion that we are so attached to this physical reality and this physical body and these thoughts and this earth and all these material things that, and our identity and our ego, that we think this is all that there is, and we get attached to it, and we forget that we are this infinite, unlimited, incredible, creative, blissful soul or spirit that has all this unlimited potential. But we get stuck in this little me, 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 I, egocentric universe that we live in, and forget about this massive, beautiful life that we actually have that is beyond, the material realm. And I can say that through experience, like, I believe that to be absolutely true, because, the deeper and deeper my meditations go, the more and more I experience that. I experience that vastness, that unlimitedness, that inner joy and peace, that, the feelings of bliss that start to become tangible, like, through actually feeling outside of my body and moving beyond this material world. And there's a great documentary on Prime called Death and Back. And a lot of people have probably heard near-death experiences, NDEs, death and backers. If you haven't, I highly recommend going and watching that, or reading some of their books, or listening to some of those stories. Because no matter where you are in the world, no matter what religion you're part of, no matter what how old you are or what you believe in, atheist or otherwise, every single near-death experience or every death and backer story I've ever heard from people are always so similar and so beautiful and so profound and so powerful that, it makes you think twice about, what am I really here to do on this planet? And then what happens when I die? Like, and we don't have time to, I'd love to, I know we have to wrap up right now. I'd love to start ask you, your thoughts on that, but maybe next time we could go into that. But I highly recommend people start listening to those stories, because they are so incredible and so beautiful and powerful. But yeah, the one on Amazon is called Death. I think it's just called Death and Back, Part One. I didn't see a part two, but really, really incredible stories. simple documentary and no high production budget, but the stories that the people share are just like, dude, like open your mind and your heart up in such a powerful way. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know we got to end it there. So what's the dude, awesome. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Great to get to know you and your work. And you're obviously a really brilliant and intelligent guy, and love what you're doing with taking these complex scientific and mathematic principles and tying them into practical things that people can do and tying them into spiritual practices. And so where can people get your book and get in touch with you and get connected with you?
Yeah, first off, thanks for having me on. I thought this was a fantastic conversation. It was fun. We really hit everything, so that was cool. Yeah, if you want to reach out, theideaspace.io, you can get the book, the first chapter of the book there for free. Right now, there's also a wait list for the app that's going to come out soon. So if that's something of interest, sign up there, and then there's a contact form there. So everything is on the website, theideaspace.io.
Awesome. Appreciate you, brother. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Nathan. Have a good one.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Nathan Crane podcast. Please make sure to subscribe and share this on social media. Then head over to nathancrane.com for your free ebook.
So when we're talking about, you know, what are these underlying causes and conditions of these chronic diseases, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, they all have very similar, if not identical, causes. And that's the thing, is when we get to the root cause of these diseases, we can not only prevent these diseases from ever happening, but empower our bodies to heal from them.
In every one of our cells, we have tens and hundreds of thousands of chemical reactions that are happening every second that are cycling back and forth, and it's like sort of a yin and yang.
And you know, for me, the soul's purpose is evolution. It doesn't care about comfort, it cares about evolution. And so I think so long as we are following our soul, then we will evolve. And I think what sometimes blocks us from living our purpose, from manifesting that next level of our expression, is we have not evolved.
There is also a time for letting go all the expectations and relax and just breathe and be grateful for what you have achieved.